It's Wednesday, September 28th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, we'll talk about the presidential debate from just about every angle you can imagine. The candidates, the coverage, the fact-checking, Lester Holt's performance as moderator. We're also going to talk about Pope Francis's statements last Thursday, calling irresponsible journalism sown in gossip a form of terrorism. And we'll talk about an interesting piece in the Washington Post begging the public to stop calling the media as the media, so it's a single entity. It's more nuanced than I'm going to be able to explain in a single sentence or two, so stick with us and you'll see more about what I mean. But let's get started with the big story that will undoubtedly have a shift in our local media landscape here in mid-Missouri, the sale of the Columbia Daily Tribune. By Saturday, Gatehouse Media will officially own the city's evening paper, ending 115 years of local ownership, 111 of them by the Waters family. This came as a huge shock when this news came out on Friday.
When I heard the news, I was completely shocked and so in a lot of ways saddened, because there are not very many family-owned newspapers, especially one that's been owned by one particular family for as long as this one has.
One family longer than the Missouri School of Journalism has been here.
Exactly. And they are a part of the community, and they've been here for an extremely long time. They understand the community. They understand what people in the community want in terms of news and information. I'm concerned as to whether or not Gatehouse will have that same sort of connection. And I'm really concerned about the people who work there, mm-hmm. because a lot of them have been here for a long time. And they are a part of the community as well.
So let's touch on a couple of those issues. One of the things that we do know is that what was said in all the statements last Friday is that on day one, the only two people who are going to be losing their jobs are members of the Waters family. All of the other employees in either editorial or production or sales capacities are still going to have jobs.
I'm sure that's true for a while anyway.
Day one.
I mean, we do know from Gatehouse has laid off or done some buyouts at other papers around the country. But then again, so has the Tribune under the Waters ownership over the past few years, because the economics of local newspapers are in trouble and have been for a long time. And, you know, the Waters family basically acknowledged that they needed a group owner to bring the kind of resources that a group owner has to be able to keep the paper going. That doesn't mean we shouldn't, you know, mourn the passing of a family paper. I agree, you know, with Ernest. They've been around for a long time. And even though some critics think maybe the Tribune has sided with developers over other interests at times, there's a single family has cared enough about the community to provide consistent coverage of that community. And I also think it's sad when you lose that kind of pressure on our own media, especially the Columbia Missourian, to have an outside interest running the paper rather than a local entity that we need to compete with. That doesn't mean Gatehouse is going to do a bad job. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying that it's going to be different.
No, I'm not predicting that. But if you go back and you look at what Gatehouse has done when they moved into other communities.
Tell us a little bit more about Gatehouse its reputation, its history.
Well, Gatehouse came out of bankruptcy, I think it was about 2 years ago. And they began a push to buy newspapers. And when they purchase these newspapers, they've gone in and they've done what they've set up what they call hubs. So they'll have one particular newspaper in a particular area that will handle most of the news in that area and then ship it out to their other properties. And that's what they were talking about doing with the Columbia Daily Tribune as well. The Tribune will be the hub for the newspapers that it owns in Missouri. They own the newspaper in Mexico and in Boonville and a couple other places. So it'll be the hub. One of the issues with that is that local coverage, you begin to miss that local coverage, or you don't have as much local coverage because you've created that hub in those areas. And it's another way for them to sort of maximize or maximize their the talent they have. But in maximizing, they minimize the staff, which means they're cutting back on reporters. They can cut back on copy editors and that sort of thing.
I mean, what's going to matter is whether they can come up with a successful business model that runs counter to what's happening elsewhere. Gatehouse does have a digital marketing arm that they can bring to bear to things. They also have an event planning agency, which could bring more local revenue in. And if those things work, then maybe it'll be a net positive. But if I were employees, not of the Tribune so much, if I were employees in Mexico or Moberly or Boonville or Joplin or Kirksville or all the other places they've got papers, I'd be the ones who'd be worried about my jobs as this hub concept goes into effect.
Right, you're absolutely right. I mean, I do agree with you, Mike, that there are some digital aspects that the Columbia Daily Tribune under the Waters family just couldn't do because they couldn't generate enough revenue locally to make those things happen. So they were struggling to keep up with the changing way of distributing news that other news outlets have gone to. And so that was one of the things that they talked about in their explanation as to why they made the decision now to sell to a publicly traded company.
So Mike, you started to touch on this a little bit. With the exception of KMIZ, which is our ABC and Fox affiliates here in this market, and some commercial radio stations mainly doing music formats and news talk, but without a whole lot of local news. One of the things that the Columbia Daily Tribune did was it kept us on our toes here at the School of Journalism with the Missourian and KOMU and KBIA, really providing us with another professional outlet that we were competing with on a daily basis. And the fact that it was locally owned until this week meant that there were people here who very much cared about this. Do you think that having corporate ownership coming into this market, does that change that for us?
I think we'll get a sense of this if we answer one big question, which Gatehouse says they're going to answer in the next couple of weeks. Who is going to be the new publisher? They're going to name a new publisher. The Waters family is out. Is this new publisher going to have any local roots or regional roots? If so, that's one way of looking at that and whether or not we can expect to have the kind of local competition we talked about and local commitment to the market. If it's just somebody, you know, else from elsewhere that doesn't have any ties to Mid-Missouri, that might be another answer.
And that can have a trickle-down effect, because if you bring in a publisher from somewhere else, more than likely he or she is going to want to bring in people who they've worked with before. What does that mean for those who have been the main editors, Jim Robertson and others who've been there for a while? What does that mean for their positions within this new structure of the Columbia Daily Tribune?
And frankly, just the competition alone is really important to keep other media on their toes. Mm-hmm. We've been very lucky over the past many years to be a two newspaper market.
Smallest in America.
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't happen very often. Right. And now we're going to be still be a two newspaper market, but one of them is going to be corporately controlled. And I don't know what that will do.
And you know, we've also been, I mean, the Columbia Daily Tribune has been a training ground for many of our students who have gone on and worked there before leaving and going somewhere else. I'm concerned as to whether or not that's going to continue under corporate ownership, because there was a connection between the Waters and the Columbia Daily Tribune and the School of Journalism. Mm-hmm. Even though we were in this competition, it was a healthy competition. It was a friendly competition, and I think both entities were served by that. Now I'm concerned about whether or not
that will continue. You don't see a lot of that anymore.
No. And you know where that local commitment really stands out to me with the Tribune, and that was their investment in state government reporting. And we've talked on this program a lot in the last couple of years about the decline in state government reporting at a time when people really need to know what state government is up to. I hope the priorities don't change at the Tribune under Gatehouse to de-emphasize what has been a real strength for them.
Well, perhaps I'll see it as an opportunity to have that filter down into some of the other local papers that they own and take advantage of it there. Well, what were you doing Monday night? If you say you were watching the debate, I'll tell you, you weren't alone. The first debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton drew in more than 80 million viewers, the most in a presidential debate on television history. Mind you, that doesn't even include the number of people who watched on PBS or C-SPAN or those who watched online. Count them in, and we're talking closer to maybe 100 million people. Your initial reactions to what you saw on TV on Monday night.
I mean, I was gratified to see that the public was paying attention. Now, we should say in context that as a total percentage of the population, this audience wasn't as big as the Reagan-Carter debate back in 1980, because there's been a whole lot more American citizens than there were back then. Still, a lot of people were paying attention. And my personal reaction to it was, the way it was handled, the format, and we'll talk more about Lester Holt in a little bit, but everything I think conspired to give us a really good look at the candidates as unvarnished as we're going to see them on national television. And I appreciated that.
You know, I think this was, I agree with you on that point. I heard someone say yesterday was that this was one of the moments where people who really hadn't paid attention to the campaign, they got a glimpse of what what the political junkies have been seeing for the last 15 months. They were able to see Donald Trump in this kind of environment. They were able to hear some of the things from Hillary Clinton that they hadn't heard, because a lot of the coverage has been more about how each one of them was talking about each other, even though they did a lot of that.
There was
also some policy conversation in there, and so some discussion about what they would do if they won the election. So they were, at least a large segment of the public was able to see that for the first time.
The split screen, who do you think that helped the most?
Hillary Clinton. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really did. I mean, I watched it, and every time they went to split screen and I looked at Donald Trump and I was like, he really needed to have a screen so he could see his appearance. I mean, it was the expressions on his face, the talking over her, saying no, that's not true, and all the other things. The coughing, the sniffling, or whatever he was. I mean, it just, the whole image of, are you looking presidential? She looked more presidential on a split screen than he did.
And it was interesting to me because, as a lot of media observers pointed out right after the debate, it's impossible to believe that Trump wasn't told how important it was to be seen properly with the split screen. He had Roger Ailes as one of his advisors, knows everything about political debates and news
coverage. So do you think part of that may have been the reports that he never actually prepared with somebody playing the role of Hillary Clinton, so he didn't necessarily have somebody baiting him in conversation to practice having that poker face?
I'm not sure. I mean, somebody asked me about this yesterday, and I said, maybe he went into this debate thinking that it was going to go the way all the other debates he had done back during the primaries with the other Republican candidates. I think what he failed to understand, or what he didn't pay attention to, is the fact that it's one-on-one, and you're going up against someone who has been debating since high school. And, I mean, she's in a Super Bowl lead compared to the other debates that he was in. And I think he went in, he was totally unprepared.
And I don't actually think it was just the split screen where we saw that, happening, the lack of preparation. I mean, she did bait him several times.
Oh, yes.
Whether you think that, she was treated lightly or he was treated unfairly or whatever, she successfully baited him. And as the debate went on, he just got further wound up more and more. Whether you had the sound on or the sound off, you could just see that he got into what a lot of people call word salad, just throwing out a lot of words that didn't seem to sync together. There wasn't a lot of punctuation or complete sentences. He got, really riled up as the moments went on. And you'd think if you were prepped, as she clearly was, she didn't rise to the bait a few times when he laid it out there for her, but he did.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was almost as if you could see it happening. I mean, if you were watching, you were going like, uh-oh. It was almost like she'd say something, and then he just...
When she got him on the tax thing.
Oh, the tax thing. When she got him on the stamina, and he went down that road, and when he did it, I went like, no, don't do. And then she just laid into him, and I think a lot of it goes back to the fact that he just didn't prepare, and I don't think he realized that what he does on the stump doesn't work in a debate. And if you go back and you look at other debates, any presidential candidate, or any race for that matter, if you try what you do on the stump in a debate, you're going to come out on the negative end.
Of course, we have to also step back and say, does it make any difference in the long run? I don't know.
I mean, don't think it will.
When
Ronald Reagan debated
week,
Mondale, but he didn't win the first debate. I mean, when Barack Obama debated Romney last time around, he lost the first debate.
Right.
Still won the election. So right. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I'm with you, Mike. After the debate, my wife turned to me and she said, what do you think? I'm going like, it didn't change. Anyone who was supporting Trump before the debate were still supporting Trump after the debate. And the same with Hillary Clinton. And the question becomes, what about the undecided? I mean, the undecideds are sitting there and they're going, but they may be saying, I still don't like either one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And I don't think this one debate has solidified in their mind which way they're going
to
go.
Well, we'll have to see if we have a second debate, given how many of these debates, the second one has been the pivotal one because of Donald Trump's claim that the microphone didn't work and he wanted a working microphone. I saw something on Snapchat Monday afternoon that the New York Times had something like 17 people in the newsroom doing nothing but fact-checking the candidates Monday night. And that was just one newsroom. The focus on fact-checking really took center stage, even almost more than what the candidates themselves were saying.
Partly because there's been a lot of debate in journalism circles about whether we have a special obligation to fact-check when one candidate arguably tells more whoppers than the other. Mm-hmm. We also had at least both camps were trying to convince the media they should fact check in a certain way. Hillary Clinton even called out fact checking and pointed to her own website during the debate. So there was a lot of pressure to do it. And I think some of the efforts to do it were actually useful.
NPR and the LA Times among them taking the entire transcript and annotating the debate itself.
No, I agree. I mean, I think here's my impression of the whole fact checking thing. I think part of it was that the media felt like it had an obligation to the public to fact check both candidates. But I also think it was the media trying to make amends for the fact that we went for 15 months without doing the fact checking that we should have been doing from the beginning. And now all of a sudden, now that we're in a general election, we're less than 60 days away from the election. Now all of a sudden they're saying, well, we're going to be looking out for you. Well, you know, there's some who are saying, you know, you should have been looking out for us way back when, and maybe we wouldn't be at this point right now had you done that.
I do worry a little bit, as I've said before, about just how close to the truth we can get with fact-checking.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I thought NPR did a really good job because basically, as you said, Amy, in line with the transcript, they simply pointed you to news coverage or resources that addressed whether they were accurate or not. They didn't say pants on fire, mm-hmm. liar, or whatever it was. Right. They just laid out the information because I think a lot of people these days are just immune to fact-checking, especially if they perceive it coming from the other side.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I heard a piece this morning where Donald Trump was basically saying that all the polls were showing that he won the debate. And I went, what poll are you looking at? Because all the polls that I saw... Okay. I just have to leave. Yeah.
What else am I going to say?
Yeah,
Chances are they were his polls.
Right.
Let's turn our attention to the debate's moderator.
Good evening from Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. I'm Lester Holt, anchor of NBC Nightly News. I want to welcome you to the first presidential debate.
And as you would expect, there has been high praise for Lester Holt's performance and some heavy criticism, in part for moments like this one, where the candidates seem to take control.
Well, you haven't done it in 30 years or 26 years,
well,
any number you
I've
want to do.
I've been a senator,
you
Donald,
haven't done it.
And
you haven't
I
done
have
it.
Been a
and
secretary of state, and I have
your
done
husband signed
a lot.
NAFTA, which was...
Sometimes they spoke right over Holt, not letting the moderator get a word in edgewise.
Segment, we're continuing
well,
the subject of
Well, at least I have a plan to fight ISIS.
Prosperity.
No, no, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
So that fourth voice that you heard in there is from Michael Grinbaum of the New York Times. You can hear his entire analysis on our links blog from the New York Times. But let me ask you for yours.
I think Lester Holt did about as effective a job as he could. I mean, he held Hillary Clinton to the fire on certain aspects. He held Donald Trump to the fire, in particular when they were talking about whether or not he supported or didn't support the Iraq War. But the way in which the candidates were sparring with each, I mean, he just couldn't get a word in edgewise at certain points because they were going to make sure that they countered whatever the other candidate was saying. I mean, there was a lot of counterpunching going on in this debate, and it was difficult for him to sort of referee, to sort of split them up and say, hey, go to your corners and then come back out and we move on to the next segment.
I mean, I'm going to sound like a broken record because I've been saying this leading up to the debates for the past few weeks. I don't think it was Lester Holt's job or it's going to be any other moderator's job to be there doing fact checking and making sure that both candidates get asked the same number of critical questions. I want to see them arguing with each other, not arguing with the moderator. I do think Lester Holt did a good job. There are critics who will suggest that he should have asked about Benghazi or the Clinton Foundation, if he's going to ask Trump about birtherism and others. Okay, fair enough. I wonder if he would have gotten around to asking those questions if they hadn't been chewing on each other so much of the time and the format allowed for that to happen.
Well, should he have made a better attempt to control the clock a little bit? I read somewhere that Donald Trump interrupted Hillary Clinton 55 times. She interrupted him 17. Does Lester Holt have an obligation to step in and get that control back in to make sure that both candidates have an equal voice?
Well, once they started down that line, yeah, it was difficult for him to do that. I mean, Trump was not going to yield the floor,
okay,
in order for Lester to try to gain any control. And Hillary was not going to allow Trump just to say things and get away with it. So once they start headed down that road, there was no way to bring that back.
I think it would have been difficult for him to do, and I'm kind of glad he didn't do it.
I am too.
I will say this much. Okay, you can critique him somewhat. But what I found was really telling. Right after the debate, reporters asked Donald Trump, did you think Lester Holt did a good job? He did a good job. The questions were fair. It was only after his sycophantic, you know, colleagues in the media like Sean Hannity got a hold of him afterwards that the next morning, all of a sudden, Lester Holt wasn't fair. My microphone wasn't working. Excuse after excuse after excuse. So consider what was said immediately after the event before the handlers got a hold of him. And I think that'll tell you something.
I mean, but if you go back and you look at debates, the first one is always awkward for whoever the person is who's moderating.
Absolutely.
And it gets better as they go along. So the next moderator is going to learn something from this.
So did he pave a smoother road for Anderson Cooper and Martha Raddatz and Chris Wallace?
I wouldn't necessarily say he paved the smoother road, but at least they know what to expect,
okay,
if Trump goes the same route of not preparing.
And if you want to ask really specific questions, you're not going to get them all in one 90-minute debate. That's why we have three debates. Yep. It's also going to be really interesting next time because it's the town hall debate. So the public or selected members of the audience are going to get to ask some questions. And we'll see what happens then. I mean, what I remember from town hall debates in the past, when you had Al Gore creeping up on George W. Bush or when you had Bush's father looking at his watch.
Yep.
And those were telling moments more so than anything they said.
Okay, well, I want to read you a sentence written by Washington Post reporter Paul Fari. He says, there is no such thing as the media. It's an invention, a tool, an all-purpose smear by people who can't be bothered to make distinctions. He goes on in an open letter to readers to point out that there are hundreds of broadcast and cable TV networks, 1,000 or so local TV stations, a few thousand magazines and newspapers, several thousand radio stations, and what feels like an infinite number of websites, blogs, newsletters, and podcasts. Add that to Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram. They're all the media. What's his point here?
Well, I think his point is he was hoping to sort of nudge the public to begin to look at the media as, for lack of a better term, as individuals as opposed to one large group. And so when someone makes disparaging comments about the media, they need to be more specific about the media in which they're making those comments about. I think that's where it was going. I don't necessarily think it works, but I think that's where it was going.
I worry that in this context, it's just going to be read as excuse making. But he has a point in a couple of ways. I remember our former Dean Mills. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the time and very vociferously, he would say, media is plural.
Right.
And he's right. I mean, not just grammatically, but he's right in a very other important way.
The way it actually exists, he was right.
Because there are all these multiple news organizations and journalists. They have a lot of different points of view, areas of emphasis, biases, whatever you want to say. Don't judge everyone. And yet, if you ask the public about the media, then you get these depressingly negative statistics about trust or bias or whether you're looking out for me. If you ask people about specific media, especially their local media, you get much more positive reactions. So it does matter how we define the term.
I mean, in some cases, it's even the particular story that comes from a particular media that people may have a problem with. I mean, to me, it goes back to there really needs to be at a very early age some form of media literacy, news literacy, so that people have an understanding about when they talk about the media, what media are we talking about? If I'm looking at this particular show on this particular channel, what am I expecting to get as opposed to if I turn to this channel and I get this, what am I getting there? So I think that's necessary, especially in the society in which we're in right now.
And I hope we don't take what he's saying just as an excuse, because it does matter when institutions like the media or politicians or big business or organized religion are thought of so negatively. If we want to hold up the core of these principles that we as journalists espouse, and we want the next generation of journalists to not only adhere to them, but the public to care about them, then we have to worry about the institution and not just our own individual situations.
Okay, so speaking of the institution, I had used some pretty large numbers to illustrate how large that landscape really is. And those numbers only counted outlets here in the United States. You can imagine how those balloon when we look abroad. And that's what drew my attention when Pope Francis equated journalism based in gossip with a form of terrorism. He told the Italian National Journalists Guild that they have an obligation to go the extra mile to seek truth, especially in the era of around-the-clock reporting. It seems a little bit hyperbolic, but Italy's newspapers are known for publishing rumors being heavily politicized and being a vehicle for retaliation.
Well, I think this is the Pope getting his first taste of that. I mean, he comes from Brazil, mm-hmm. which also has some of that, but it really doesn't go so much toward the church itself. And then now he's in Italy, he's in Rome, and it's happening, and he's sort of taken aback. And I think that's where maybe some of this is coming from, because there are some issues that they're having within the Catholic Church that sort of lends itself to the rumor mill and the politicizing.
So I guess my reaction was kind of varied. And one, I mean, the Pope is right that the news media can be used as a weapon. Journalism can be used as a weapon just as effectively as a lot of other things. I was a little bit turned off by the use of the word terrorism, because I just think sometimes when we do go to the point of when you compare somebody's actions to Hitler or the Nazis, people tune out. When you compare people to terrorists, people tune out. Those words have meaning mm-hmm. that can be lost if we're constantly engaging in hyperbole. I'm not necessarily saying the Pope is wrong, but I think that the impact of that can be less. And then the other thing I think is, on the other hand, in this sort of social media soaked world, the only way the Pope's going to get any attention for his concerns about the media is to use a word like terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like as you said, words have meaning. And I think in this case, you know, the Pope used a word that he knew was going to attract attention.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. And a quick reminder that if you missed any part of today's program, or you want to listen to it again, we've got you covered. Audio podcasts are available on the KBIA website, the NPR One app, and iTunes. And if you want to watch the program, we're on YouTube and Facebook as well. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Megan Sheets is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.